You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, How to Turn Your Independent Film into a Money-Making Business by Alex Ferrari. For a free copy of the audiobook, head over to www.filmbizbook.com.
The Director Series is made possible by the support of our subscribers on Special. Subscribe today at special.tv/The Director Series and gain access to exclusive full-length Director Series episodes and other bonus content, ad-free. Welcome to the Director Series podcast, a show dedicated to deconstructing the work of some of cinema's most celebrated and influential film directors. I'm your host, Cameron Bile. The terms we use to describe cinema allude to its nature as a visual art form. Movies, motion pictures, films. The bulk of the medium's first three decades of existence were almost exclusively visual, until 1927's The Jazz Singer popularized the practice of syncing picture to pre-recorded sound. The image, therefore, is the most fundamental and most pure aspect of cinema, the most basic building block. The manner in which these various building blocks are arranged naturally determines the shape of the story, but it also reveals the shape of the builders themselves. Some builders are content to arrange their blocks as others have done, following pre-established blueprints that guarantee structural integrity and a coherent form. Other builders, however, arrange their blocks in new shapes entirely, challenging our fundamental assumptions about the medium. Many filmmakers use their work to break new ground in visual language, but very few have dedicated the entirety of their life and career to it like director Terrence Malick has. Since his debut with 1973's Badlands, Malick has consistently pushed the boundaries of narrative storytelling and structure, elevating his work from the realm of entertainment to that of poetry. If cinema can be thought of as a visual art dealing in space, time, and motion, then there's a case to be made that Malick is its purest practitioner, a priest who sermonizes through film and sees the movie house as a kind of cathedral where the faithful can gather for a shared transcendent experience. Malick looms large in the cinematic psyche for a variety of reasons. His aesthetic has influenced a variety of pop culture mediums like music videos and commercials, and prominent contemporary filmmakers like Christopher Nolan cite him as a key influence. One of the most mysterious aspects about Malick is his personal aversion to the spotlight. He's gained a reputation as an eccentric recluse who values his anonymity to the point that he doesn't make publicity appearances, give interviews, or even allow his picture to be taken on set. He's relaxed this position somewhat in recent years, but he's still fiercely protective of his private life. There's also his infamous disappearance from the industry altogether, with a 20-year gap in the middle of his career where nobody can fully account for his whereabouts or actions. Simply put, Malick endures because he has cultivated a myth about himself that's larger than life. The same can be said of his work, which deals in the language of American myth-making, folklore, and spirituality. The late Roger Ebert was a champion of his work. His final review was a rapturous, beautifully written response to Malick's To the Wonder, a film that many other critics derided upon its release. Ebert considered Malick's work to have a single, unifying theme: human lives diminish between the overarching majesty of the world. To put it another way, Malick's work posits that our human dramas are rendered insignificant by the radiant beauty of the natural world. Yet, being creations of that world ourselves, we are inherently connected to it in a spiritual sense, made beautiful by virtue of its association. This sentiment echoes throughout Malick's to date 9 films. His sensitivity to the poetry of life imprinting his work with an emotional intellect and palpable philosophical overtones. With each subsequent work, he seeks to refine and perfect a special harmony between picture and sound, even as it ignores long-established storytelling conventions and puts him increasingly at odds with critics and mainstream audiences. Especially as of late, critics tend to regard Malick's work as obtuse, pretentious, and boring. They charge that he keeps making the same film over and over again. To a certain extent, they're correct. The same themes and aesthetic flourishes show up time and time again with a dependable consistency, right down to his use of meditative voiceovers delivered in hushed tones. This shouldn't be confused with the notion that he keeps remaking the same film, however. His signature themes, abstract concepts like the natural harmony of the universe, all of humanity belonging to one cosmic soul, transcendence, the eternal conflict between reason and instinct, the clash between the industrial and the agrarian, and the majesty of myth, are so vast and profound that a lifetime's worth of feature films doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of a comprehensive exploration. Malick is well aware he can't possibly plumb the full depths of such heady concepts in one lifetime, so he fashions his films as ideological way stations for us to anchor ourselves to while we forge our own expeditions into the interior unknown. His filmography has spawned many imitators over the decades, but he nevertheless remains an entirely original, unique, and vital voice in contemporary American filmmaking.
The world was like a faraway planet to which I could never return. I thought what a fine place it was.
Malick's own story begins on November 30th, 1943, in Ottawa, Illinois. The first son of Irene and Emile A. Malick, young Terry knew both pain and privilege in his formative years. The American dream had been especially kind to Emile, whose own parents had been Assyrian Christian immigrants from Lebanon and what is now modern-day Iran. He found intellectual fulfillment through his work as a geologist, as well as financial fulfillment when he became an executive for an oil company. Terry's childhood was spent in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, as well as Austin, Texas, where he attended St. Stephen's Episcopal School and is still reported to reside, at least as of 2011. The three Malick boys, Terry, and his brothers Chris and Larry, were raised to excel in academics. This high-pressure environment had differing effects on the brothers. Whereas Terry's intellectual inclinations propelled him to assume a cum laude A.B. degree in philosophy from Harvard, his musically gifted younger brother, Larry, intentionally broke his own hands over the pressure of his music studies. This episode, and Larry's apparent suicide shortly thereafter, proved to be a formative experience for Terry, with echoes of the event reverberating through the interior dramas of films like 2011's The Tree of Life and 2015's Knight of Cups. During the summer of his college years, Malick put his quiet life of academic privilege on hold, in favor of hard manual labor in the great outdoors, working on oil rigs and driving cement trucks and rail yards. For his graduate studies, Malick left the U.S. to attend Magdalen College at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. But after getting into a disagreement with his thesis advisor over the philosophical writings of Kierkegaard, Heidegger, and Wittgenstein, he dropped out altogether. Upon his return to the U.S., Malick taught philosophy at MIT and served as a freelance journalist for Newsweek, The New Yorker, and Life magazine. All of this is to say that, at the tender young age of 26, Malick had already lived a well-rounded life full of many academic and professional accomplishments, and yet he'd barely scratched the surface of the man he was destined to become. He would find his true calling in 1969, when he enrolled in the American Film Institute's inaugural class alongside future luminaries like David Lynch and Paul Schrader, in pursuit of an MFA degree in filmmaking. It was here that he made his first film, a comedy short called Lantern Mills that featured himself and a young Harry Dean Stanton as Old West cowboys trying to rob a modern bank. Malick's stint at AFI also proved beneficial in terms of his connections to the industry, marking the beginning of long creative partnerships with classmates like Jack Fisk and Mike Medavoy, who would go on to become his production designer and agent, respectively. During this fruitful and exploratory time, Malick married his first wife, Jill Jakes, and began working as a screenwriter, doing uncredited passes on Don Siegel's Dirty Harry and Jack Nicholson's Drive, he said. Under the pseudonym David Whitney, Malick also wrote the screenplays for Pocket Money and The Gravy Train. When his script, Deadhead Miles, was made into a film that Paramount found to be unreleasable, Malick decided to take his fate into his own hands and become a director himself.
My girl Holly and I decided to kill ourselves, same way I did her dad. Big decision, huh? The reasons are obvious. I don't have time to go into them right now. One thing, though. He was provoking me when I popped him.
By this point, Malick had become something of a protege of director Arthur Penn, perhaps best known for his trailblazing crime classic, Bonnie and Clyde. Naturally, Bonnie and Clyde provided the raw cinematic template for a fictional story that the 27-year-old Malick drew from the real-life murder spree caroled by Charles Starkweather and Carol Fugate. Fascinated with Starkweather's dark charisma and cool narcissistic detachment from the magnitude of his crimes, Malick hammered out a screenplay about two young lovers on the run while on a road trip himself. The more he wrote, the less his story became about the sensationalistic crimes of Starkweather and Fugate, and more about his childhood home and the particular way he internalized his appreciation for the natural world. Giving his project the title Badlands, Malick set about putting the pieces in motion to make his first feature film. This being an independent film, the process of financing the picture was the most difficult and most urgent aspect to be dealt with. Towards that end, Malick put in $25,000 of his own savings and raised an additional $125,000 by pitching wealthy doctors and dentists. Around this time, he also met Edward Pressman, an aspiring producer who had recently inherited a successful toy company. Pressman managed to kick in a matching contribution, providing Malick with a combined $300,000 in funding to start shooting his first feature film. Taking its title from the eponymous National Park in South Dakota, Badlands begins in the tiny rural town of Dupree, sometime in the late 1950s. The story is told from the perspective of a naive and virginal teenage girl named Holly, played by Sissy Spacek in one of her first film roles.
And what's the man I'll marry going to look like? What's he doing right this minute? Is he thinking about me now, by some coincidence, even though he doesn't know me?
Through her disaffected voiceover, Holly gives us a relatively banal overview of her world, sharing details about her beloved dog, the dollhouse-like Victorian home she shares with her stern and overbearing father, played by Warren Oates, and even her baton-twirling routine. Malick meticulously sets up this dreamy world of suburban nostalgia and childlike wonder, only to smash it all to bits with the introduction of an aimless 25-year-old trash man named Kit.
You want to take a walk with me?
What for?
Oh, I got some stuff to say. Guess I'm kind of lucky that way.
Played by Martin Sheen in his breakout performance after toiling away for years as an obscure journeyman actor on television, Kit is detached, aloof, and emotionally distant to a sociopathic extent. He fancies himself a small-town James Dean, only without the talent or ambition. After losing his job as a trash man, Kit finds temporary work as a ranch hand, and fills his spare time by pursuing a romantic relationship with Holly. Naturally, this comes as a contentious development for Holly's possessive father, who expresses his displeasure by shooting Holly's dog. When his pleas to the father's sentimental side wither on the vine, Kit decides that the only way he and Holly can be together is to remove the father altogether.
What are you doing?
Got a gun here, sir. It's always a good idea to have one around.
He does just that, shooting him dead in cold blood and setting his quaint Victorian house ablaze before driving off into the night to start a new life with Holly. Drunk on the ambrosia of first love and blinded to the implications of their murderous actions by their youthful innocence, Kit and Holly slowly make their way westward, learning to live off the grid and racking up an alarming body count in an increasingly desperate bid to cover up their tracks. As they venture deeper into the wild American frontier, Kit and Holly realize that their passionate love affair is going to be short-lived, and that their day of reckoning is coming up fast on the horizon. The triumvirate of Sheen, Spacek, and Oates anchors Badlands as a character-focused chamber piece, despite the sprawling backdrop of open road and endless sky. Other supporting actors come and go as needed, filling out their world with interesting shades of regional color. Indeed, Malick's tendency to let his camera drift from his lead actors towards the fascinating facial landscapes of his extras begins here, with shots that linger on the weathered, corn-fed faces of America's heartland and counteract the polished Hollywood beauty of the two leads. In a way, the cameos of Badlands are more interesting than the performances of its supporting players, at least in retrospect. An inconsequential shot of two young boys playing under a lamppost becomes much more compelling when we learn that those two boys are none other than Martin's sons, Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez, making what one could argue as their film debut. The most compelling cameo of all is the one belonging to Malick himself.
Hi.
Hi, Mr. Scarborough here?
For decades, the only public recording of Malick's image or voice was here, playing the character of an architect making a house call to a rich man that Kit and Holly are holding captive.
What's that?
Well, I'd like to leave a message, if that's okay.
Sure.
The move was made out of necessity when the actor scheduled to play the role never made it to set, and Malick had no choice but to step in. His brief appearance in Badlands is arguably one of the most dissected and analyzed cameos in cinema history, done in the hopes that the slightest of verbal quirks or physical mannerisms might hold some profound revelations about one of the art form's most enigmatic personas. It's evident for all to see now that Badlands heralds the arrival of a major new talent in American cinema, but it hasn't always been that way. Indeed, the road to classic status was long and riddled with potholes. In deciding to produce on top of his directing duties, Malick quickly thrust himself into the logistical chaos of making an independent feature film. David Handelman's article for California Magazine, titled Absence of Malick, details a rocky shoot in which the first-time director forfeited his own salary, asked his cast and crew to work for peanuts, and couldn't even guarantee his investors that the film would be completed or distributed. On top of that, Malick's creative energies were constantly divided by insurance costs, equipment damage, an increasingly mutinous crew, and, apparently, angry landowners brandishing shotguns. His relative inexperience, combined with his total conviction in his artistic vision, drove a revolving door of cinematographers that began with Brian Proben, who reportedly felt that Malick's approach to coverage was incoherent and refused to shoot the film as his director desired. The second cinematographer, Tak Fujimoto, was eventually replaced by a third, Stephen Larner, before production ultimately wrapped. By virtue of shooting in unauthorized locations with very little money, Malick would later joke to the press that the process of shooting left him feeling like he too was on the run, just like his protagonists. Handelman's article goes on to note that by the last 2 weeks of principal photography, all that remained of Malick's crew were himself, his wife, his art director and friend from AFI, Jack Fisk, and a local high school student. Badlands debuted at the New York Film Festival alongside fellow director Martin Scorsese's breakout picture Mean Streets, but even its selection for the prestigious festival was fraught with peril. Anecdotes recount a catastrophic preview screening for the festival board, where the picture was out of focus and the sound mix was unclear. Even the print itself reportedly broke down. Despite this series of outright disasters, the festival programmers couldn't deny the visceral power of Malick's fresh new voice, and gave Badlands the prestigious closing night slot. Based off the rave reviews from its premiere, Warner Brothers swooped in and paid just under $1 million for their distribution rights. This perhaps was likely the worst thing that could have happened to Badlands at the time. The studio knew they liked the film, but appears they didn't know what to do with it. Leaning heavily into a scheme that marketed the film as a pulpy genre picture, which it most decidedly was not, Warner Brothers released Badlands as part of a double bill with Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles. The general release critics didn't share the same view of Malick's first feature as the festival critics did, and Badlands subsequently languished in box office oblivion. Determined to prove that the film could indeed perform, Pressman and his team programmed a second release, booking Badlands into small regional theaters on its own. Pressman's risky gambit proved inspired, with audiences finally catching on to Badlands' brilliance. As Malick's filmography has grown, Badlands has only become more enshrined as a cinematic classic, as well as an iconic work in the new Hollywood wave of filmmaking that elevated such contemporaries as Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, and Steven Spielberg to prominence.
You know who that sumbitch looks like? You know, don't you?
No.
I'd kiss your ass if you don't look like James Dean.
Badlands' mark on American culture was etched in stone when the Library of Congress selected the film for a spot in the National Film Registry in 1991. Its first year of eligibility. Over 40 years after its release, the power of Badlands endures, beckoning audiences again and again with a dreamy, golden-tinged nostalgia for an America that never really existed, except maybe in our own delusions. Thank you for listening to the Director Series. For a deeper dive into your favorite filmmakers, go to www.directorseries.net. The Director Series is made possible in large part by our generous supporters on Patreon. Please visit us at patreon.com/directorseries to see how your contribution enables the continued production of video essays and text articles on your favorite contemporary and classic film directors. Thank you.